Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you're listening from, and welcome to 1% Better, the podcast where we take a look at hidden stories in sports. I'm your host, Zylan Fanake, and alongside me, is, as always, is Dr. David Lipman. David, how are you today?
Good, mate. Really good. More importantly, how are you post Two Oceans?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I'm recovering from my first ever ultra marathon that you have coached me to, and super, super happy with how it went. I told you before, I don't know if I was naive, that I was really confident going into it. You said, no, you actually should be confident based on what I have been running and managed to execute. And man, yeah, I only have good things to say.
And you paced it like a boss too. For those who haven't seen his splits, we should throw them on our socials. You split that thing perfectly. Given the hills especially, you paced it perfectly, man.
Yeah, I actually had the morning after the race, I had one of the local a coaching friend of mine who owns a triathlon squad phone me and say, she basically said, your splits were unbelievable. Everyone got to the marathon. They died after the marathon mark. You, despite that's where the hills come, managed to almost maintain your pace. You did not lose that much time. The point I'm trying to get to is, can I have a conversation with your coach? What is he doing? Because he's doing something right. And can I learn from him? So kudos to you, man.
I appreciate that compliment, mate. But I know some very good coaches who coach some very good athletes. And ultimately, pacing is about the athlete. It's not about the coach. Like, that pacing and execution is about you running within yourself and running it correctly. Now, I can tell you to do that, but I've seen many people not do that. So the pacing's about you, mate. Yes, I might have contributed a little bit to how you've been conditioned and your prep, but certainly, mate, that pacing, that's not a Dave thing. I had almost nothing to do with that.
Pacing is fascinating. It's something I've always noticed in the races. When people pass me in races, I can very quickly tell whether they're out of their comfort zone or whether they're well within their comfort zone and they're doing well. Now, people who are out of their comfort zone, can they not tell that they're out of their comfort zone and they're going too fast and they cannot maintain that? So for people who don't know the Two Oceans Marathon, it is 56 kilometers, approximately 33 miles. The first 28 kilometers are pan flat. I mean, you are getting 3 miles for nothing. In fact, it's slightly downhill. So you want to be saving energy because after that, you have the first climb, Chapman's Peak Drive, which is an unreal climb. Of the most beautiful views of the ocean that you will see in Cape Town, South Africa, against anywhere in the world. And then after that, you get Constantia Neck, which is an even harder climb. And it is tough, I can tell you. I saw people walking there. Most of the field were walking there. So if you don't pace the first 28Ks correctly, you pay a very heavy price. I started the race extremely conservatively. I had literally hundreds of athletes come past me, hundreds of runners come past me in the first 5Ks, first 10Ks, first 15 kilometers. And I could tell the majority of them were out of their comfort zone. I had a friend who I was actually staying with who I knew would probably finish anywhere between 30 minutes to 45 minutes behind me, just based on knowing him and running with him and training with him, etc. He caught me at the 18 kilometer mark and I said to him, what are you doing, mate? Why are you here? Why am I seeing you? And he said, oh, I'm feeling good. I said, of course you're feeling good. We've only done 18 Ks. It's all slightly downhill. We've done nothing yet. And he ran away from me for 50 meters and I called him and I said, Silas, I promise you, come back to me, stay with me. All these people are passing us. We are going to see them again. Trust me. This race hasn't even begun yet. I had to stop for a loo break, so off he went. I think I caught him again at 26 kilometers.
Wait, you stopped to go to the toilet?
Twice, yeah. To empty my bladder.
And you still ran. I mean, firstly, we got to talk about that, like being an adult, mate. But secondly, like you still ran a really quick time given that, so well done.
I actually stopped drinking so much after that second loop break. I'm like, what am I doing here? Why am I weeing so much? I'm gonna stop drinking this bottle in my hand.
Well, that's not great news for our sponsors, but let's actually touch on that quickly. So thanks again to Precision Fuel and Hydration for sponsoring the episode or sponsoring the podcast in general. Again, 1% better, all spelled out, lowercase letters, for a 15% discount on your first time order. or follow the links in our show notes. You can go either to the link there, and that will get you 15% automatically added on your first order. Or if you go to the fuel planner there, they will help you plan your race nutrition, and that will automatically add the discount as well on your first order.
I actually spoke on a previous episode on the impact that their salt tablets have had on me, how I'm very prone to cramping, and the majority of endurance events I do, I cramp. Since I've started using Precision Fuel and Hydration salt tablets, bam, they've done it again in this ultra marathon. I did not cramp once. Unbelievable, man. But yeah, I was super, when the climbs came, I was just super strong running through the field. I think due to three things. One, I actually trained hills. You always say that you look at what your goal is, what the race is, what the terrain is, then you work backwards and you go train that. So I've been running hills for months, and when I got to the hills, I just felt in my element. Second thing is nutrition, completely on top of it, like just no issues whatsoever. And the third one is pacing. So it felt, yeah, it felt good to be like a rock star. And just, I think in my group, you know, with regards to running through the field, I think I started around 3,000th, ended up at the finish line around 1,300, somewhere there. So just showing like running through the field, which was nice. Well, good pacing.
We should throw some of that pacing stuff on the socials, mate, as well. Not just your paces, but also where you came through the field, because it's really impressive and it shows people. And we can, let us know if you want to do an episode on pacing. I think, send us a DM on Instagram or an email. All that's in our show notes as well, all those contact details. Happy to do that episode. But as a throw forward to some episodes coming up, we do have an episode on fueling, under fueling specifically, coming next week, and probably the following week, maybe a little while later. We've got some shoe stuff, which is interesting because you bought new shoes at the expo, mate, after giving me all of the stick about all the shoes I buy, mate. What, somebody talked you into buying race shoes there that weren't race shoes? What's the story?
Yeah, you bought race shoes in Berlin Half Marathon. I give you a hard time for that. So I had to top that. Bought some Asics Gel Nimbus 26s. I was in the market for new shoes anyway. Like an idiot, I have not been keeping track of my mileage on all my shoes that I use, and they're all expiring at the same time. So the Asics Cumulus was actually one that I was looking at for the longer runs, like the 30K runs, etc. on the weekends. The Asics guy at the expo said to me to try both the Cumulus and the Nimbus. The Nimbus was just unbelievable. So much more cushioning, just felt so good. But yeah, he tried to convince me that that should be my race shoe for Comrades Marathon that's coming up, my big goal of the season, 85 kilometers this year. Absolutely not. After running the Ultra in my Nike Alpha Flies again, I forgot how amazing the shoes were. Wow, they are unbelievable. I got a new pair coming actually this week, so I hope the new pair is going to be as good as my well-worn in ones that I've done 3 Ironmans in, a bunch of marathons in, so... I think I'm definitely leaning towards the Nike Alpha Flies, which is interesting because in this episode, we go deep into super shoes.
Yeah. And as to why maybe they weren't as helpful as you think they might be, in your running, given how many runs you've done in them.
Yeah, exactly. What's happening with you? I saw last weekend you had a great run. You've been, for people who don't know, you've had a long journey back from injury, etc. You did Berlin Half Marathon. We touched on that, and then training seems to be going well.
Yeah, I was super sore after Berlin Half, which is rare for me. It's a volume thing. In the same way that you're not quite that sore as you expected from Two Oceans because of your volume, I'm a bit sore because I'm not used to as much volume. Quickly went up to altitude for like 5 days, which is just enough for it to ruin you, ruin your sleep, ruin your recovery, all that stuff. Did some running up there, was a touch sore, but was running better. It's interesting because I slept better up there than I had been before being at the same place, and also ran better despite the fact I'm less fit. So it makes no sense. The previous time I was up there was just before I ran Boston. So I was in great shape. But anyway, came down from altitude and had an absolute, I thought I'd be okay, but I think it's just relativity. I ran really well. Went through some like trails that were a little bit muddy and still ran 17 kilometers pretty quickly over the weekend. So yeah, pretty happy with that. Happy with how I've come off it. It's about, you know, it's bang on a month of being back running. And that's usually, most people say, yeah, after about a month, you get like kind of used to it. So we talked about my rebuild previously. Early in the week last week, I was a little bit worried that I had done a bit much, had a bit of shin pain. And then by the Sunday, I was like, oh, no, we're good. We're going to go aggressive again. So we'll see how we go. Watch this space. I could either be injured or flying next week. Who knows?
So quickly, I want to move on. But why would you be in such a rush? I don't know if that's the right word, to add more intensity into your running. Is it just to keep you entertained, to fast track your fitness? Do you have other goals coming up? Why wouldn't you be patient and just do like zone one, zone two kind of running as you come back?
So I'm not adding intensity yet. So I would just be pushing volume more than intensity at this stage. I will bring back intensity soon, because like ultimately, if you want to run with intensity, you have to add some intensity. There's no question. My big thing, as we talked about on previous episodes, for those who haven't listened, is I've got Lavaredo Ultra 50K at the end of June. And so I'm like concerned about getting enough volume in before then. So that's like why I'm pushing the rebuild a little bit more aggressively than I would otherwise do. It's kind of the reason for that. So yeah, but not a lot of intensity. Been doing some intensity in cross training. Similar approach to what I've taken with you actually, mate, is like, let's limit running injury risk by adding intensity elsewhere. So get that physiological stimulus from something else. So I've been doing some time, some intervals on the assault bike, which makes me feel ill. So just thinking about it.
Well, it's all in the name. Should we get on to some community shout outs? You wanted to say hi and thank you to someone this week.
Yeah, well, not so much hi. More thank you to Eamon Ring. So Ringo is a guy that I went through my undergrad with, and then he actually went into a postgrad and I ended up teaching him briefly. Amazing sports person, very good triathlete, now transitioned to CrossFit and was a very good touch football player as well. He reshared our social reel on talking about footwear, because he's a podiatrist, obviously, and a shoe geek like me. So he loved what we're talking about with what shoes to lift weights in. So shout out to Eamon for sharing this month's 1% Better Challenge. Really appreciate it.
If he loved that, he's going to love this episode. Would really, really like to get his feedback on what we are about to go through in a second. Let's go through what's come across your desk this in recent weeks, David. The first one, we've talked about cycling so much on the show, but it is relevant. We spoke about Wout van Aert from Visma Lisa Bike, who had crashed in Dwars de Vlaanderen, and that meant he missed a lot of his early season goals. That has now been extended. He has announced that he's out of the Giro d'Italia, which was his major goal for the first half of the season, which makes sense. It's only now about 18 days, about roughly 3 weeks to the Giro. So, I mean, that decision's almost made for him, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of half called that. I didn't know his race schedule, but I sort of said he'll be away. I mean, late last week, he took his first walk and had a shower. Like, he's missing so much skin. Like, it's just not worth it. He wants, as we said, the Olympics and that sort of stuff. And so this doesn't surprise me. One thing I think it's probably segues well, mate. We're going to start a new segment. I've been thinking about this a bit because I don't want to be negative and talk about injuries, but I think hopefully people enjoy like learning a little bit more about what this actually means, because you sometimes hear like he's come off the bike and, you know, they put a positive spin on it, but it's nice to hear like, hey, actually, if this is what's happened, I don't know how realistic that is. So on a similar note, mate, this will segue well into the new segment we'll do called The Doctor's Office, talking about some stuff, just quickly touching on it. And again, not wanting to trumpet these things and make them a big deal and be positive, but I do want to inform people about it. And on that note, poor old Magnus Ditlev had a fall in prep for the T100 in Singapore and fractured his scaphoid bone, which is the bone sort of beneath your thumb. Pretty common injury when you fall with an outstretched hand, or so-called Fuchs injury. And scaphoids are tough because it can be hard to diagnose. If you do diagnose it correctly, it's a high risk of not healing, because it's one of two bones, the other one being the navicular in the foot, where if they don't heal well, you've got a high risk of them having avascular necrosis, which is kind of when the bone dies off. And that's a really bad outcome, because you can have ongoing pain and poor function and that sort of stuff. So not an injury to be messed around with, but it's also, it bears a lot of weight through your hand. So as soon as I heard what the injury was, I was like, oh, this guy's not going to be riding a bike for a long time. So he probably can ride, but he can't take weight on it. So he'll probably go home. If I was Magnus and his team, I'd be trying to do some riding without touching the handlebars, so on a trainer indoors, and maybe not much intensity, because it's hard to do intensity like that. Maybe he can get down into TT position, but even then, maybe not. You don't want to enforce too many bad habits. I would be doing enough of that, whatever running he can do pain-free, and then he probably can't even swim. And if he can, he's going to be careful with it, because it could be quite painful, and you know, ongoing injury to the area can cause a risk of not healing. So you don't want to mess around with it.
Yeah, I saw Cam Werfert actually sent him a comment on his Instagram and saying, luckily, you're one of those rare athletes who love riding on the indoor trainers, so you can get back on the bike and smash it. And he does have, I was watching his Sweat Elite YouTube channel, following him for 48 hours at home. And he's got a cool, and he's got a cool setup that he's got access to in Copenhagen in a basement and riding on Zwift there. So that'll happen. So that'll help him. But he was actually in Singapore for the PTO's T100. We're talking about triathlon here. So T100 is, you know, what the PTO has put together for professionals mostly, and then also amateurs, and 100 being the distance that the race makes up to, which is a 2K swim, 80K bike, and an 18K run. What was happening there? You were following. I mean, you are a triathlete. You've become a triathlete fan through and through, mate. You've been following, texting, updates from the race. What went down there?
Yeah, I mean, so this speaks to some of the stuff that we are passionate about, mate, and why one of the reasons we started this podcast is, like, once you engage or understand a little bit deeper, meet a person, interview a person, something like that, you start to have buy-in. So I got buy-in to so many stories in triathlon now because I got involved because of the Norwegians and interviewing them. And then now just I'm a fan of the sport. I like some of the personalities in it. And so it was cool to
the
watch.
The Norwegians being Christian Blumenfeldt, Olympic gold medalist, and Gustav Iden, 70.3, and Kona, I'm Ironman world champion, for those who don't know.
Yeah.
David just, he's so cool. He doesn't even name drop anymore. He just throws like passport titles.
I mean, sure. I mean, I never really name drop, but sure. So anyway, super interested to watch this race. I also love particularly Singapore and the T100 because like the course is interesting. It creates a level of jeopardy. And this is something where I get frustrated. I love running, but like watching a big city marathon like Berlin, there's no jeopardy. It's kind of like, all right, everyone runs along and then they all slowly burn off and then like the leader wins. It's like, there's not a lot of excitement there. That's why I was excited when I watched Boston on Monday, just go on, and we will recap that for people in the coming weeks. We just wanted to make sure this wasn't too long an episode for you. So if Boston is coming up, we will talk about that. But so it was just, the jeopardy was great. It was jeopardy in the women's race with, you know, Lucy Charles Barkley leading and then Ash Gentle running through the field. Like everyone else was like running backwards on a treadmill. It was insane. And then you had this jeopardy of Sam Long getting penalties and then coming through the field and doing all this stuff and the heat and the course. It was all just, I love the jeopardy of it. You're sort of guessing too late. It's cool to see Yuri come through the field, like, well, you know, be so strong that day. But I noticed some cool things that I thought we should talk about that are, you know, not just about the storytelling, the jeopardy, which is there and is real. The women did a really good job of this. I don't actually think the men did as good a job from what I saw anyway. The women were doing a great job of grabbing ice, throwing it down their tri suits, letting it cool themselves. And Ash Gentle specifically was running with ice cubes in her hands. Now, there's some really cool research on cooling your hands and what that does to your sensation and body and of how hot your body is. So specifically cooling the hands. There's a product on the market which cools your hand between like exercise to help you perform better. So it's a really interesting research around this perception. And there's also some research on ingestion of menthol and what that does to your cooling sensation as well. So it's really fascinating. It's kind of like the swish and spit research around carbohydrates, where you take a little bit in your mouth and spit it out and it still gives you an ergogenic benefit. It's kind of like a bit of a hack thing there, which is quite cool to see.
With the hand, I'd never heard that before, but just thinking about it now, to me, it would make sense from the point of view of the hand is the part of your body that touches most things outside of yourself first. So surely the brain learns that's the part of the body that quickly gets a signal, or I'm talking about like, I don't know, 0.00001% faster than if it was on your arm or your neck or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like, would that make sense? Is that why?
So there's a bit more to it than that. So there's quite a bit of blood flow to the hand is the first thing. The second thing is that the sensation in your hand, the nerves, are quite a lot more sensitive than, say, your back. And there are different types of nerve fibers, but the pain ones also sense temperature. And the hand is quite sensitive to pain in that respect as well. So there's a high density of nerve fibers there. So it's probably a combination of those things. Maybe a little bit of like, yeah, this is what you test the environment with. That's kind of what you're talking about. There's also a really interesting reflex called the diving reflex, which is in children, which helps them get through the birth canal, which sort of usually dies off as we age, where if you cool your forehead, you'll find your heart rate depresses quite quickly to help you, and your metabolism slows down a little bit to help you get through the birth canal. Because if you think about the way most babies come out, they go forehead first. So it's quite interesting.
Wow. Yeah, I saw Yuri, the men's winner, had he was empty when he crossed the line, and they had to take him off to hospital. He couldn't even attend the podium ceremony. They had to take him off to hospital.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this with respect to calling people off after heat in a previous episode. Like, we pretty much just need to call you down as quickly as we can and then check and make sure everything's okay. In a heat, on a race that intense from a, I mean, the water temperature was 30.9 degrees. Like, it's basically bath water. Wow. Like, that's the water temperature, let alone the outside area and all that stuff. Like, you lose so much sweat that, like, you just need to make sure that everything's okay from a fluid, electrolyte levels, all that stuff. And then as soon as you have electrolyte abnormalities, and he may or may not have had that, you do risk things like the cardiac system going a bit haywire. So you take him to hospital, especially if you're in a foreign country, he's going to fly, like, take him to hospital, make sure everything's okay first and go from there.
Cool. That's all we have time for on this episode, checking out what has come across your desk. All right, let's get into the main topic of discussion for this episode, super shoes. And there's been some relatively recent research we want to dive into. David, I've got 1,000 questions for you. You are a shoe nerd. I'm pretty sure you have a problem. You're addicted to running shoes because you send me a message pretty much weekly with a new delivery at home with new shoes.
That is not fair, but the awkward thing is I actually have a delivery that arrived this morning. So whilst it is not fair, I'm also...
Exactly. Stop talking. You've lost this one. I rest my case. So talk to us about super shoes. How much do super... I guess let's start with the elites, because that's where the shoes were released. We see the times tumbling all the time. We're going to get to how relevant they are for us, amateur, age group runners, etc. But talk to me about super shoes and how much they help elite runners.
Yeah, I guess, so for context, most people are familiar with them, these shoes, often called carbon-plated shoes. I think the reality is what makes the magic in these shoes is a mixture of using plating material or carbon material or something similar, the ability to put that sort of super foams around them. So the foams are often what they call PBACs or PBA. And so using the mixture of that foam, the stability that these components like plates or rods give them, and then what that allows you to do from a shape perspective. So it's not one or the other, because the carbon fiber plates have existed for years in shoes and they weren't that great by themselves. And these so-called super shoes exist without plates, or these, you know, these foams exist without plates in some of these shoes, and they are lovely, but they're not as performance enhancing. So it's special sauce, right? It's not the salt. It's not the tomatoes. It's the mixture of everything together that, you know, that your grandmother did all together. So it's the magic mix of all of it. And it's also why, and we'll actually get to whether how helpful this is, why there's limits to stack heights in these shoes for now triathlon late last year after Gustav Iden's magic shoes in Kona in triathlon, but also certainly in athletics as well, track and field. So those regulations are different. The stack height limitations are 40 millimeters in the roads, and they, I believe, 30 or 20 millimeters on the track. So they're slightly different between the two.
In Kona, as you're referring to, Gustav wore on running shoes. Were those like 50 mil stack?
Yeah, thereabouts, something like that. So much higher than 40. And I think they might have had multiple plates in them as well, because there's a limit to the number of plate components and whether they can overlap and all sorts of stuff. So we're not going to rehash that. If you want to hear about all that stuff, we can certainly send us a DM on Instagram or something like that, and we can certainly point you in the direction of some stuff to listen to. But we don't need to rehash that. I don't think it'll serve people. I think most people are probably familiar with that already. And so most people would probably be using these and be familiar with the fact that they probably work. But an interesting study came out, and, you know, we got links to all this in the show notes, but this was called Does Advanced Footwear Technology Improve Track and Road Performance? Sorry, you'll have to edit this, Alan.
Excuse him. We're not editing anything. I'm leaving this in. Excuse him. He just hopped off a plane from Australia to London and had one night's sleep and insisted he's good to go to record. I disagreed. You make your minds up, listeners.
That's not fair, mate. I'm not so good at reading in public, apparently. Does advanced footwear technology improve track and road racing performance? An explorative analysis based on the 100 best yearly performances in the world between 2010 and 2022. What I really like about this is it's still using the pointy end of the field, the top guys, but it is not using the single best of the year, because that person or those people, handful of people, could easily be an outlier. So let's take the 100 best. I think it's a really cool way to do this. Let's look at the 100 best performances. That's going to get us at least 20 people from each biological sex, maybe more, probably more. And let's look at what's happened year on year on year on year, right? Because these people are going to serve as their own controls as well. They're going to be there in perhaps, you know, 2011 and then 2015 as well, right? Or at both Olympics. So there's certainly going to be that. You're also going to get generational shifts and differences. So I think it's a really cool way of doing it. So to take the 100 best. So there's, you know, they found evidence of progressing improvements in track and road running after the introduction of these shoes in 2016. And that's really important here. So they took data from 2010 to 2022. And from 2016 onwards, they noticed a progression. So again, you've got a control space in there, which is prior to the introduction of these, the original Nike 4%, right? So they noticed a progression from 2016 to 2019. This was more pronounced in distances longer than 1500 meter in women and longer than 5000 meters in men. And that should spark your spidey sense to note that women probably see more benefit in distance running events than men. We can talk, you know, we can speculate as to why perhaps. There is some benefit in the sprint events, obviously, the 100 to the 400 meter hurdles, 100 meters up through to the 400 meter hurdles. Peak performance gains in 2021 and 2022 compared to the pre-AFT ranged from 0.6 to 1.1% in women and ranged from 0.4 to 0.7% in men. Now, again, that speaks to women seeing a little bit better, more benefit than men. It also speaks to when the super spikes came in, because remember, super shoes started and then super spikes are much more recent. They're also more recently being used in these events. And I can't remember exactly who it was. I think Amusan, I think was her name. She was a hurdler that used a middle distance spike for hurdling because of an injury she had. But there were some questions about whether it was performance enhancing to have this foam in sprinting as well.
I haven't heard of super spikes. Talk to me about that. Is that carbon in the spikes or what are those?
So spikes have had carbon for years because you need them. They need to be stiff. So carbon provides something very stiff. So spikes have had carbon for donkey's years. It's the foam. So again, it's the magic of the foam and the spike and the plate, not just one or the other. So it's been, they've increased the stack height, they've added this foam, and then they've got the plates in there already because they've got plates. You have to have a carbon plate to have the spike plate on there. So it's all that stuff. So Nike, you've got the Dragonfly. On have got the 10,000, I believe it is. And there's a few other spikes on the market. Brooks have got a pair, et cetera, et cetera. So they certainly do help. And in a similar way to what we would say, which is, when I run in super shoes, I'm less sore, I can do more, I can run faster, I feel faster. That's what you hear from people who run on the track in these things. So certainly the case. So for middle distance, so they're calling that 400 meter to the 3000 meter steeplechase. I don't know if I agree there. I'd say 400 is probably still a sprint event, and I'd say 3000 maybe falls, 3000 steeple probably falls into distance, but we're not here to split hairs about that stuff. They saw peak performance gains ranging from 0.6 to 1.9% in women and 0.6 to 0.7% in men. So again, we are seeing the, you know, sort of more benefit in women. And then for distances 5,000 meters to the marathon, performance gains ranged from 2.2% to 3.5% in women and 0.7 to 1.4% in men. Now, crucially here, it begs a question of, are we seeing the effect of the acute effects, as in all things are the same, I put on the magic shoe and then I run a faster time? Or are we seeing a subacute chronic effect, which is I train in these and I race in them and therefore I'm better? Or are we seeing the effect, you know, or is the racing irrelevant? And I don't think that's the case, but there is an argument that it's just the ability to train in these shoes because you recover better. And I don't think that's the case. I think it's probably the combination of the racing in them is truly helpful in itself, but there's also a chronic training effect there that we see in these things, which is you recover better, therefore you can do more volume, you're less injury prone, etc. So I'd certainly say that that's a component here to look at as well.
Let's talk about non-elites wearing super shoes, because believe it or not, I still have friends who go, how can these shoes work? I don't know about them. And these are all people who haven't tried them. Everyone who's tried them, there's no debate. Like, so talk to me about the benefits to non-elites.
And I think it's a really important question, and it's worthwhile noting because these were made for the elites. There's no question. And of course they, like in Formula One, they want that to filter down to the everyman or the every runner, but the way they make them, they're tuning them to be run in for certain things. They're tuning them for the elites, perhaps one elite in mind. not even all the elites. And we'll talk about variance in different shoes for different people later in this episode. But just because I've tuned the shoe, if I tune the shoe to, for somebody who's running a 2-hour 20 marathon, right? Or a 2-hour 13 marathon now for the women or whatever, that will probably work really well for some elite men, sure. But it probably doesn't, like the thinking very reasonably is maybe it doesn't work for a 2-hour 45 or longer, say marathon runner. And I can certainly feel this in some shoes. For instance, I got a pair of the Adidas Pro 3s. They certainly feel a lot better running around 3 minutes 20 to 3 minutes 30 a kilometer than they do slower than that. And that is right in and around women's elite paces. I can't run faster, much faster than that, so I can't say about men's elite paces, but it's right around women's elite marathon pace is where these feel the best to me compared to slower paces. Now, that is shoe specific. I've definitely don't feel that as much in other super shoes. But what I'm getting at here is if these are made for people who are running that pace, people who are running that pace generally have similar characteristics in terms of ground contact times, transition from heel to toe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All these components that are essential in how the shoe feels. And so there is a chance that they don't necessarily help recreational runners as much because recreational runners are on the ground for longer. They're slower. They come off. The forces are different. So maybe it's not as helpful. And maybe being on the ground then, these shoes are less stable and similar to a road bike tire versus another tire. Road bike tires have enough stability when they're moving fast, but when they're slow, maybe not. It's the same story here with these shoes is maybe you can fall off the side of these shoes because of the forces and the sort of the slower speed there. But anyway, in this study, which was recreational runners gain physiological and biomechanical benefits from super shoes at marathon paces, they compared super shoes and regular running shoes. The problem I think I had with this study, and this is, again, the shoe geek talking in me, they used the Saucony Endorphin Speed 2, or Saucony, if you will. It's not the superest of super shoes. I'd say that it's probably made more as a trainer, and maybe that's where they see benefits here, but it's not the superest of super shoes. They could easily have used the Endorphin Elite or the Endorphin Pro or whatever. So caveat that, but you know, I'm not going to throw too many stones. These studies are hard to do. So oxygen consumption in the Endorphin was 3.9% lower than the Cohesion, which was their comparator shoe, at 65% of the velocity at VO2 max. There's an interaction between the shoes and the speed, of course, meaning an increased difference of 5% at 80% of velocity of VO2 max, which is to say, when you're running slower, they don't give you as much benefit as when you're running faster. All right, so at 65% of VO2 max, they gave about 3.9% lower oxygen consumption, whereas at 80% of VO2 max, they gave 5% reduction VO2 max. So anyway, these speed equivalents, just for context, to see how recreational these runners were, 65% of VO2 max was equivalent to 9.4 kilometers an hour, which is a 6.23 per kilometer, whereas 80% of velocity of VO2 max was equivalent to 11.5 kilometers an hour, which is 5.13 per kilometer. So very reasonable paces for people to be running, to be called, you know, recreational runners.
So you're benefiting from it. So most people can benefit from this. But like, talk to me, what is that benefit? Why are they benefiting from it? Is it that the landing is not so hard? There's more protection for the muscles and ligaments, etc. Where's the benefit coming from?
Well, I mean, it's hard to... I would say it's... The easy answer is economy, which is what this is testing, which is like how much oxygen are you using to run at a submaximal speed? That's an economy measure. So they're improving your running economy. And now there is an argument that non-elites will benefit more because their economy is worse and because they have a greater exposure time, right? So Eliud Kipchoge is running 2:05. Now we get super shoes. Now he runs 2:01. Okay. But his total exposure time to get better was, say, 2 hours and 5 minutes. Whereas if you're running 3 hours, you've got more exposure here. So there's an argument to that. There's also an argument that because you're less trained, you're less conditioned, you've got more muscle damage and these will protect you more. There's certainly those components there. There's also an argument that their ability to keep working degrades over time across 2 hours or across 3 hours. So they made there. So we don't really know. We have to look at it all, but or it would need to be studied, but it's quite interesting. What they did notice in this study was that there were small increases in what they call vertical and leg stiffness, which is basically how well you pop off the ground. In the Endorphin shoes. And they also showed a trivial to moderate decrease in step length. Trivial to moderate differences in step length, step rate, and contact time and flight time, which means some of these things changed a little bit, not a great deal. But basically, it's really to do with how the shoe works. A lot of what they're doing, and this is from other research, is decreasing the work at the foot and ankle and then shifting that load to higher up. So you fatigue less, those muscles that fatigue more and are less fatigue resistant sort of get less work, and that allows you to endure more and suffer less muscle damage, etc. Another study, effects of highly cushioned and resilient racing shoes on running economy at slower speeds, slower running speeds. So that we know already that the Nike Vaporfly line of running shoes improves running economy between 2.4 and 4.2% at speeds 13 to 18 kilometers. So that's 436 up to 320 per kilometer. So we know that already. But in this study, they used the Vaporfly 2 and versus a control shoe. And in 16 runners, they looked at trials of both 10 and 12 kilometers an hour. So that's 6 minute kilometers and 5 minute kilometers. And for these data, it appears the Vaporfly 2 still enhanced running economy at these speeds, but they are small, like the benefits here are smaller in magnitude compared to previous research at faster speeds. So again, it probably looks like you need to hit these at a certain velocity for them to have the effect, but they're still working at slower speeds here for people. And again, we are looking at running economy changes here, which is to say how much less oxygen are you using? And that is showing a benefit. Now, that is not an improvement in speed. It will translate probably to an improvement in speed, right? You finish the marathon a little bit quicker, but that is not a linear thing. 4% improvement in running economy doesn't improve your time 4%. It's probably more like 1% or 2%.
Running economy being you're using less oxygen, meaning it's less demanding on the body. Is the body using the amount of oxygen it needs? So less oxygen, you're more efficient.
Yes. So at these speeds, so they're testing them at a specific speed. They're saying at 6 minute kilometers, you're using less oxygen to run. Therefore, also at, we'd anticipate that being held true across all speeds of your running, maybe not the same amount, but at all speeds, you'll be more efficient. Also allowing you to run slightly faster at your maximum, your VO2 max, right? Which is the maximum amount of oxygen you can use. So that is to say running the same pace will be more efficient. You'll use less fuel for that. And when you're running at max fuel, that'll be a little bit faster. So,
okay, got it.
That is basically what we're looking at here. But I guess it behooves people to realize that we are looking at economy running that pace at a certain amount of, for a short period of time, 4 to 6 minutes. We are not looking at durability, which I would wager increases, which is to say that you can sustain that for longer and not see the same increase in heart rate. I would also say that race time would probably improve, probably in a non-linear fashion, which is to say it would be hard for us to understand exactly what that race time improvement would be. So an improvement in economy in elites is a little bit easier to understand because they're so efficient and everything is so tuned. In a sub-elite or non-elite or a recreational runner, that would be very different. And I think we may actually see that late, like these shoes have different effects earlier versus later in races for people who are less well-trained.
I mean, the one question that springs to mind is, with these studies, is the most efficient way to do these studies in a controlled environment? Because I'd imagine, are they taking into consideration in a non-controlled environment outside in the real world? Are they taking other factors into consideration? Weather, nutrition, fueling, recovery, like, you know, life stress, etc.?
Well, the point is we don't want to take those into account. We want to remove those as noise from the data. So that's why we put them in a lab. That's why we do this testing the way we do it. But your point is, yeah, how helpful is that to the every runner? Like, I want to know when I put these on, how much better am I going to get on average most days? And there's not a lot of ways to do that study at a mass scale for people. You could probably send a bunch of shoes. Like, someone like Strava could do this. They could say to people, listen, we're going to send you a couple pairs of shoes. We want you to run, just do your normal running, but I want you to really keep note of when you're running in what shoes. And we could look at average paces, heart rates, decoupling, all that stuff at for thousands and thousands of runners with a super shoe versus not. Now, you can't remove things like the Michael Jordan effect, which is I feel better when I put these on, right? So Michael Jordan famously played a new pair of shoes each night because he said new shoes have like a special thing and that's what he wanted. So you can't remove that effect, but you certainly can. Through that much data, you may start to see some patterns of like, hey, they are X amount more efficient over a certain period of time. You probably need to be a bit more specific, which is, hey, we need you to go run. We signed you up to this race series and we're going to randomize the order in which we give you these shoes. So you'd have something like let's do 10 races of the same distance, 5 or 10Ks or whatever. Probably not marathons because they're too long, but like 5K, 10K, half marathon. We're going to give you pairs of super shoes, pairs of not super shoes, and we're going to have people who have no super shoes at all, so they can't even train in them. Now we're going to get you to run, and we're going to randomize the order in which you run in these shoes, and then you would probably have a number of groups who are sort of on or off because weather, all those things, and then you would look at that. But, I mean, those studies get very difficult to do. You have to get people to listen to you, agree. They have to not get injured, so, like, it gets very difficult. But we'll talk a little bit later about some of the research around how to choose super shoes, and then that probably gives us insight into, if you are choosing them, it also gives you an insight into how you could track them to see if they're actually better for you and what that difference is. But I think, if I'm honest, part of the reason these shoes have succeeded is because there isn't really a lot of debate here. And what I mean by that is you put them on, you go, oh, these are different. Like, this isn't the same as what I was wearing before. Like, these are not, this is chalk and cheese here. So I think that's probably the one of the main reasons they've actually succeeded. But again, I don't know if you're familiar with the Pepsi and Coke taste test, this famous story, but they used to give people Pepsi and Coke, and they'd get them to taste test, a blind taste test, and people almost certainly preferred Pepsi. But what they found was the reason they preferred Pepsi was it was sweeter, but over a can they preferred Coke. So Pepsi fans, don't add us, don't send us in. The story here is, just because you put it on and it feels good initially doesn't mean it's going to be what you prefer to race in, right? Or be what you prefer to run in. We've all put, like, I worked in a shoe store, I put on tons of shoes. First feel is crucial to selling it, but I will also tell you that's not necessarily representative of what it's going to feel like in 10 kilometers, let alone 40. So they have probably succeeded at both. They have great first feel, and that in that they feel very different as well. And when you run in them, you feel very different straight away and at the end of a marathon. So I get it. I get why they work.
Interesting, man. Now, you alluded to this earlier. How long are super shoes good for? Because that was one of the first things that I heard when they came out, is that you're getting half the mileage out of them than traditional shoes.
I'd say that's probably a good estimate, if I'm honest. Depends on how many you think you're getting out of traditional shoes. Because, again, when something like this comes to market as well, it has trickle-down effects to the rest of the shoe market. So these foams are now in things. So, like, the Nike Invincible has this magic foam without a plate. So, like, they don't last very long at all because they bottom out. They don't have a curvature. So, like, your normal shoes, so to speak, are not normal anymore. So compared to traditional EVA shoes, like, if you can find a pair of those, they don't quite last as long, that's for sure. And this paper here, influence of different midsole foam in advanced footwear technology, use on running economy and biomechanics in trained runners, is the paper. So compared EVA, which is traditionally what was used as the foam, the midsole foam. So the midsole is, there's the outsole, which is the grip, and the midsole is sort of what the meat of the shoe, so to speak. And then there's the inner sole, which is what your foot goes on that you can pull out from your shoe. Right? So the midsole is that. So compared to EVA, which was the traditionally used in sports shoes, and PIBA midsoles. So they compared these two, PIBA being the magic stuff, and they compared them in old and new. So you had four groups, old PIBA, new PIBA, old EVA, new EVA. And this was in trained male runners running at 13 kilometers per hour or 436 per kilometer. So what I liked about the study, the researchers went and ran the mileage in these shoes. In many of these studies, they'll put like footsteps, like a machine that does footsteps to fatigue the shoe. They didn't do that. They went out and ran these kilometers in these shoes. So they put 450 kilometers into the shoe. They ran that. So why that's important, I think, is that the outsole impacts how a shoe feels and functions significantly. And outsoles will change with wear. So I think it's really important that we do that. And for anybody who disagrees with this, go find your, you know, a pretty normal shoe, whatever it is, that has a trail equivalent and put them both on, and you will feel these things feel like chalk and cheese. They are so different because the outsole is different. It changes how it feels, changes the stiffness, it changes the interface. That's also why some shoes are great on roads and not so good on grass, or vice versa, or some shoes don't feel so good on treadmills. Like, I have a treadmill pair of shoes. I'm like, these feel great on the treadmill, not as good elsewhere, and vice versa. I have shoes that I would never wear on the treadmill. So I digress. So basically what they found was, after 450 kilometers of use, the PIBA and EVA shoes had similar running economy, but the old PIBA was 2.28% worse from a running economy point of view than the new ones. So the new PIBA was more economical than everything else. The EVA aged better. the old PBAR was about the same as the EVA.
Is that a lot? 2.28%?
It's less than we've generally thought. I mean, the original 4%, you know, Nike 4% were 4% more efficient. This is saying 2.28%. So probably not. 2.28 is probably not, to be honest, like, it's not going to be much difference in a race. Again, this is in these runners who were trained, who are running 4:30 per kilometer, right? Like, it's very niche. Like, all this stuff is super niche in that respect. But I think the take home from here is that even an old pair of super shoes is probably no worse than your normal sort of average run-of-the-mill runner. What I would say, though, is be careful, because these things, shoes don't wear evenly. They don't just sort of wear like this. They can wear on angles. They can do all sorts of things. So just be a bit wary that you can, especially if you've got a stride that's a bit asymmetrical or something that's a bit funky, like, you can see, you can create problems with these. And they're not the most stable shoes in general. So they can be, I wouldn't say causative of injury, but increasing risk if they wear unevenly. So I'd be a bit weary of doing that. But I certainly have a pair, not my first pair I ever bought of these, which was late in the piece, I might add, but the second pair I had, I still use occasionally, once every now and again. And so I sort of use them as a bit of a, I still love the feeling of them. I still think they feel different to every other shoe I've ever had, the Adios Pro 2. But yeah, I sort of use them occasionally. I don't use them very often, but probably once in a while, and they're probably getting retired soon.
You were late adopter to super shoes, weren't you?
Super late.
Why?
Because, so when I originally qualified for the Boston Marathon, I ran my first Boston qualifier. I was in Amsterdam in 2018.
David just looked back over his wall to look at his medal and race number hanging on his wall to check.
Yes.
What, yeah, that was.
Yes. I don't remember. There's a pandemic that happened between then and now. I've got no idea. It's just black hole in my memory. So 2018, I ran Amsterdam Marathon, ran 2:58:57, which was under the 3-hour qualifier for Boston, which had just dropped 5 minutes. So I was like, oh, I'm in, happy days. They've increased this, whatever. But as most people know, 2018 is 2 years after 2016, when the shoes are more widely available, these super shoes. And so the time required was a couple minutes faster than what I ran. So I was filthy. I was like, listen, that's not fair, whatever. I'm going to qualify for Boston before I put a pair of these shoes on. So then I ran for the next handful of years. As we said, global pandemic hit, or you may remember, you may not, who knows, until I ran Rotterdam Marathon, which was in 2021, in a pair of non-super shoes, and ran 2:49:26 to qualify easily. I still needed to run under 3 hours. And then I went promptly and bought a pair of the Adios Pro 2s to then race from there in Boston in a pair of the Adios Pro 2s, and loved it. I've never turned back. Those things are magic. So
still, you look so proud of yourself qualifying on those shoes.
Oh yeah.
Switching.
Oh yeah. It was a point and people thought I was mad, but that's how I did it. In terms of favorite shoes of all time, the Adios Pro 2 is right up there with a couple other shoes, the Mizuno Hitagami, Nike Lunar Eclipse, a few of these other shoes. So for the shoe heads around amongst us, they're all nodding, and everyone else is like, what is this guy talking about? He's speaking.
Yeah. Let me ask the next question before we lose you completely. Why, you alluded to it earlier, why do super shoes help? Like, what studies have been done and what research do we know now as to why they specifically help and improve you?
Yeah, one of the things that could be the case is just an increase in leg length. So if obviously putting you on stilts doesn't make you faster because you can't spring off that, but there is certainly an effect here where if I increase your leg length, I increase your stride length, which means you take less strides across a marathon or whatever. So it should theoretically work. Generally, the body's pretty smart though, and it self-organizes efficient lengths with rates, because those two things are an interplay, right? So if you take longer stride lengths, you're going to have troubles keeping the same stride rate. So it will self-optimize and self-organize based on footwear that you're wearing, the surface, all that stuff, to be the most efficient, which is to say to use least oxygen. So in this study, the influence of footwear midsole thickness on running economy and frontal plane ankle stability, it looked to look at the thickness of these soles. And this was interesting because it was sponsored by Adidas. So what they could do, or at least supported by Adidas, so what they could do is standardize what went into the shoes. Because generally, if I said to you, listen, we want to look at different thicknesses, we're going to have to go buy a bunch of different shoes that are at different thicknesses. Adidas went, no, we'll make the same thing with different thicknesses. Same components in them, so we can truly isolate the effective thickness on the shoe, which is particularly interesting from Adidas, given they've got a 50 millimeter shoe out called the Primax, which I own and are awesome.
Have you noticed earlier he was saying he does not buy shoes on a weekly basis, but I hope you at home are listening and ticking off every model of shoe he says he owns. I think I'm on to 14 or 15 already now. Sorry, carry on.
To be fair, those were a gift from Matt Fox, owner of Sweat Elite. So appreciate Matt for giving me those shoes. But anyway, I digress. Carry on. They had 21 recreational runners, so 10 female, 11 male, and they had midsole thicknesses which ranged from 35 millimeters to 50 millimeters in increments of five. So they had a 35, a 40, a 45, and a 50. And what they found was it created frontal plane instability with these, with increasing heights. Now, this will be, when I say frontal plane, that is inside, outside. So like ankle sprain territory or like feet rolling in territory. So it created instability there, which makes sense. When you put these on, this makes a ton of sense. Any of these shoes, because you sink in them and that's our the least stable plane for us as, you know, as humans who are ambulant. And all of the women in this understand the following point intrinsically. And if you're a man, unfortunate, it's like putting on a pair of high heels. You get super unstable because the moment arms increase. The other way to think about it is, you know, when you're a kid and you're trying to hold the door closed and your brother was trying to push against you, if you push on the outside of that door, furthest away from where it's attached to the door hinges, it's you need less force than closer to the door. It's the same story here. If we put you high up, the moment arms are bigger, so the forces are to roll your ankles in and out are more. So you've got less stability there, which again, these shoes are not made for stability. They're made to go fast in a straight line. They did the trials at 548 per kilometer. So, you know, very applicable to our listeners for the most part versus being something else. And they isolated weight out. They removed weight as a factor as well, which can be a factor here. So if we're adding sole thickness, stack height, whatever you want to call that, then we're going to add weight. So they removed that. They added a little bit of weight to the lower ones to even this out. So, and they showed no real benefit to the increasing height of the midsole. So that's not to say more midsole isn't better because they can do different stuff with it, but as a sole thing, and this is what we were talking about before, how do you control these different things? They control the variable for stack by making the same components, keeping the weight the same, etc., and found no real benefit to it, maybe a cost in that you're less stable. But in a 50 millimeter shoe, you can achieve more things, which is why World Athletics has a limit to the stack height, because we don't know what innovation could go in there. The only way you can regulate this is like give people some rules to play within. So, yeah, I think that's probably...
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I'd say like if you're choosing shoes, there's always like... When I used to advise people in the running store or when I was a podiatrist, I used to say, like, choose on the four Fs and in this order. So fit, if it doesn't fit your foot, you cannot wear that shoe. End of discussion. No toenails gone, none of that stuff. So make sure the fit is right. There's no hot spots. Make sure it feels good. And there is evidence, and there's a link in the show notes to like one showing that feeling better is more economical, right? So the body's smart, it will tell you. Then look at the function, and function is things like stability, etc. Features are what you want and what you're trying to do with the shoe. Here it's about, what am I doing with the shoe? Is it a race shoe or a training shoe? Is it a trail shoe or a road shoe? Is it for grass or treadmill? So that's where function comes in, and choose appropriately. This may mean you need more than one pair of shoes. You see, Zion. And then the lucky last F that you're allowed to choose on, which I don't necessarily agree with, but it is here because everyone agrees with it, is fashion. So the fashion is the final F.
Very important. Extremely important.
If all other things are equal, fashion can be the fourth F. So there you go. So now in terms of choosing shoes, you can use Running Power for this. And we've got a link to an article in the show notes here. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. It kind of does, but I won't go into it too much. But basically, if you're using a running power meter, lower power at the same speed is a more efficient shoe for you. So you are using less power to go the same speed. Is basically the way to think about that. So if you're using a power meter, you would do something like put your running power meter on, run in, you know, sets of, you would do, you know, sort of 5 or 6 minutes of running at a time, probably get rid of the first minute and look at the data from the last bunch of minutes, and you would randomize the order. So you would go like one. So if we had shoe number one and shoe number two, and we were testing them against each other, you might go 1, 2, 2, 1. You might go 2-1-1-2, something like that. So you would randomize the order of it so that you would get multiple trials and fatigue wasn't the thing. You wouldn't go 1-1-2-2 because then fatigue is going to be a factor in that. So you would always sort of try and randomize it like that to look at the average of the best there because it'll be slightly different.
My day has just gone to the dogs because I've just realized what I'm going to do for the rest of the day. Earlier you mentioned Strava. And Strava, I mean, they must be sitting on a gold mine here. They got a wealth of data because you've got heart rate, speed, location, etc. And then you've got gear, what people are using for that. So I want to go have a look at, I've been giving you a hard time. I probably run in 5 to 6 pairs of shoes. Is it worth it?
Are you kidding me? Hang on a second. I run in way less than that.
No ways. I don't believe that for a second.
Matt, on a weekly basis, I probably run in 3 different pairs of shoes.
Well, I got 2 race pairs and then 3 training pairs. Probably take this with a pinch of salt, but am I wasting my time, David, if I hop on Strava later today and I go and look at my runs and I look at similar paces, maybe similar distances, and then go look at what shoes I was wearing and see where my heart rate was at, for instance, and just go look at different stats?
I think that would be helpful, but what I would say is you're never going to remove the fact that you don't wear race shoes unless you're racing for the most part. Every now and again you do sessions in them as well, that's fine, but they're not the same. So I would say something like the best way to do this, if you wanted to do it in what you're talking about, like in a real world scenario, would be to have a certain training session that you enjoy doing or do regularly, and then do that say 10 times across a period of months and randomize the shoe order you use. Some super shoes, some not, or different super shoes or whatever, and then look at that. So for me, something that I do pretty regularly is something like 8 by a kilometer, right? So I do 8 times 1 kilometer with usually like 90 seconds to 2 minutes off. So I'd look at that, look at the, and I do that in the same course. So I would look at the speeds per repetition. I would look at heart rates for that speed. I would look at heart rate recovery from that. And I would look at like the total session there and try and see how we went there.
I actually did do that in January. I'm going to go have a look at it. I think I only did 3 weeks in a row or 4 weeks in a row of intervals. Same stretch of road. The intervals had just increased from 6 reps to 8 reps over the 3 weeks, but it was the same amount, 4 minutes a time. And I wore a different pair of shoes for those. I'm going to go hop onto my apps and have a look and see at that and go down a rabbit hole today. But speaking of different pairs of shoes, then how individual are responses to super shoes?
Yeah, this study is a funny one. It was done by Adidas. They grabbed a bunch of their like world-class Kenyan athletes, 7 of the world-class Kenyans and 7 amateur European male athletes. This is one that people have probably heard about, but there was an enormous variability between subjects. And they're sort of saying, as a result of this, well, there's this huge individual variability between different shoes for different individuals. I would say some of that, I think, is about how niche the shoe is. I think you can do certain things to a shoe to make it more niche. That's going to make the responses more variable. Some things not necessarily as much. They reported anywhere from an 11% worsening to an 11% benefit in these runners, for like the Kenyan runners specifically, and in the Europeans, a 9% benefit to a 1% worsening in running economy. What that says to me, particularly the difference between these elite male Kenyan runners and the amateur Europeans, is that the Kenyans were not used to the treadmill, which would speak volumes to that. And this is something that you get all the time in studies. And, you know, we used to learn about this when I was doing my exercise physiology degrees, like you've got to let people be comfortable in a treadmill, and certain treadmills are going to be more or less comfortable. I can't run on a treadmill without a front thing anymore, but generally people find them better when they're starting out on a treadmill. So they only have side rails. There's no front or back area, but you know, different types of treadmill. Is it a curve or is it a flat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd say this probably reflects more like these guys were not comfortable in a treadmill than anything else. Again, speaking to the like, how do I choose? Well, maybe a treadmill isn't what you should be doing. If you don't do a bunch of running on a treadmill, maybe don't use a treadmill, but it is a nice way to standardize speed and those sort of things. But you can certainly do something else like an athletics track. You can run certain paces around the athletics track and look at the influence of the different shoes on you there.
You're so smart, man. Your ability to spot those things, it's exactly what this podcast is about, the hidden stories. I hadn't thought of that at all. I was going to ask you why that disparity, and that makes complete sense. We're going to link in the show notes to what we had discussed here, so the articles we mentioned and the studies. So if you're a proper shoe geek like David, go and have a look at it. David, I just noticed something on the episode. You worked in a shoe shop. You became a podiatrist. I mean, no wonder you're a shoe geek and expert. That's quite a big jump, but a very appropriate jump, I'd say.
From the shoe shop to the podiatrist?
Yeah, I would have helped you with real world life experience, seeing a lot of people's feet, seeing a lot of shoes, finding out what works in the shoe shop, you know, getting feedback from people.
I actually went the other way, mate. I was a podiatrist and then sold running shoes when I was in medical school, training to be a doctor. So, I got very fortunate. I was working in an unbelievable running store with a guy who had worked for Nike. That's a big deal there. Had run the University of Oregon at a time just after Bill Bowerman wasn't coaching as much. He ran for Bill Dellinger. So he was unbelievable. He could put a shoe on and tell you exactly what the clients would feel, the customers would feel. Taught me a ton about shoes. So I learned a lot there. And actually worked with another guy who's very famous in the running shoe world and running world, an Australian guy known mostly as Moose. I call Julian Spence, who's on one of the big running podcasts, Inside Running podcast. So got to work with those guys. So it was very enjoyable and learned a ton from them and really enjoyed it.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. As always, please like and subscribe and rate the podcast 5 out of 5. Share with a friend who you think might find this useful. You can also find us on Instagram, 1% Better Pod. Follow us over there. David, thanks so much for the enormous amount of prep work, Danya, that you've put together. Fascinating. I've learned so much today. Appreciate that, man.
Well, appreciate you. Appreciate all the listeners. Do follow us on TikTok as well. Zylan runs a TikTok account. It's his favorite thing to do. So do follow us there as well, and we'll talk to you all soon. Thanks for listening in again.